Welcome to the Faith Debate on News Radio 930 WFMD. I'm Troy Skinner, host of this show. I'm pastor of Household of Faith in Christ, online at householdoffaithinchrist.com. Joined this week, as per usual, by David Forsey. He's a pastor in the area. And Daniel Razvi, a pastor in the area. And Imran Razvi. The reason I don't call him Raz, by the way, because I think he prefers Raz. His friends typically call him Raz. But with two men with the last name of Raz, and then calling him Razvi, and then calling him Raz on top of that, there's lots of razzing going on. You know, it's Daniel Razvi and Raz Razvi, and it's just, I don't know, it's just a lot of raspberries going on. And I just want to steer away from that so I can try to keep it clear. And but anyway, if you know him as Raz, yes, he's the guy. That's the guy that you're hearing. It's him. It's one and the same. Anyway, and they have a ministry that you can find online as well at itsconqueredbylove.org. So this week, we're going to be talking about an article that came out late summer leading into the fall. It was about a pastor. The article was written by a pastor. His name is Alexander Lang, I believe. And he was, I'll just read to you how he starts off his little article, and then we'll have fodder for discussion here. This is a case study. That's why we're going through this. This is a case study on how a faith gets deconstructed even by a pastor, or a so-called pastor in a so-called church. So here we go. This past Sunday, this is not me, by the way. This is Alexander Lang writing.
Okay.
This past Sunday, I preached my last sermon as the pastor of First Presbyterian Church of Arlington Heights. That's a suburb of Chicago, for those who don't know. I have made the decision that I am not only leaving my post as head of staff, but I'm going to be leaving the pastorate altogether. I no longer have a desire to serve as a pastor in the church. In my sermon, I told my congregation that I was exhausted from writing, memorizing, and preaching sermons week after week for 10 years.
Well, that's a long time.
Which is true. However, there are other reasons why I'm leaving that I didn't have time to discuss in my sermon, and I want to utilize this article to do a deep dive into how I came to my decision. So I don't know if we have a whole lot to say, but I wanted to give the entree and give him kind of a full hearing and disclosure to the listener. We are going to read large chunks, but I printed this out, and the darn thing is 7 pages long. We are not reading all 7 pages, but we're going to read, I think, a pretty fair representative example of what he had to say to put him in context and be fair to him. But my first reaction after that first paragraph is good riddance. Don't let the door hit you. But anyway, what do you have to say?
Well, he says a lot. He doesn't really talk about what God's calling is on his life. If God has called him to do something, no matter how hard it is, you do it until God calls you otherwise. And it's one thing to retire after a long career because you are tired, with God's leading, of course, but 10 years doesn't seem like a really long time to be writing and preaching sermons. Now, he admits there's other reasons involved, so I guess we'll hear those in a minute.
One of the reasons I say good riddance, don't let the door hit you on your way out kind of thing is, based on what I understand here, and in fairness, I could be misunderstanding if that happens at least 99% of the time. So, but if this is the 1% time that I'm right, then what I'm hearing here is that he didn't preach a sermon. He's saying he preached a sermon, but he's talking about his reasons for leaving, and he didn't have time to share all of those reasons in his sermon. That's not a sermon.
No.
He speeched, right? He speechified.
It's an elongated announcement.
Right? He gave a lecture of some sort, maybe. I don't know. He gave a speech. He gave an exit farewell speech. He didn't give a sermon. That's not what a sermon is. A sermon is grappling with the scriptures and pointing people to the gospel.
Later on in the article, he's going to explain that in this service, the going away service, they played music by Coldplay, YouTube.
Oh, yeah. No, we're getting
Beatles.
There. You're jumping ahead. So you're jumping ahead. I'm going to read
it. It was
that.
Not a service.
I'm going to read that part. Here's the next part, and I do want us to spend some time talking about these 5 bullet points that he gives us. He says, I have become part of what is known as the Great Pastor Resignation. I had never heard of this until now, by the way. And I, like I said last week, I tried to pay attention to these trends. First time I've heard the but maybe I'm just not locked in on that sphere of things. Anyway, so this Great Pastor Resignation came along in the wake of the pandemic. Barna, the George Barna Research Group, did a national survey of pastors, and of March of 2022, 42% of pastors considered quitting.
Considered, not did quit. Just
right.
Considered quitting.
The reasons for this are myriad. Here are the top 5. All right. Number 1, the immense stress of the job. Number 2, I feel lonely and isolated. Number 3, the political divisions that are currently in this country. Number 4, I am unhappy with the effect this role has had on my family. And number 5, I am not optimistic about the future of my church. What do we think about those? as reasons for giving up on shepherding God's flock, leading and pastoring a church.
I've noticed, like, so far in this article, he has not mentioned God once yet, or Christ, or the gospel.
Well, I don't want to, spoiler alert, I don't want to spoil it too much, but I think you'll see that as a trend.
Yes. But that's the thing, even in these reasons, right? None of them having to do with God or godly things or the calling of a pastor. It's all I. I feel isolated. And you're okay. It's okay to feel isolated. Elijah certainly did. He's sitting at the brook with Kidron, right? And he's like, oh, I'm the only one left after he just beat all the prophets of Baal. So pastors and leaders, godly men throughout history have felt that. That's not a bad thing to have those feelings. The question is, what do you do with them, and what do you do moving forward? Elijah's ministry didn't stop there. You know, God will provide comfort to you when it's needed.
Now, one of these four strikes me as a legitimate reason for someone to seriously, prayerfully consider whether they need to leave the pastorate, and that would be number four.
I'm unhappy with the effect the role has on my family. Yes,
right. If it's doing damage to your children and your wife and stuff, yeah. Like, you've got to take care of that first.
Because the qualifications for being an elder is that you have one wife and you've got children and they're in subjection and you have your house in order. Like,
look,
that's
churches
to begin
can
with.
Find a new pastor. Your wife can't find a new husband. Your kids can't find a new father. I mean, you're irreplaceable in the family dynamic. And if you can't figure out how to manage that, and it's literally having a negative effect.
Yeah, but I don't know that that's the church's fault as much as the man's fault for not saying, hey, this is how I take care of my family, and a man should not get his family into that situation in the first place.
Yeah, and right? I wasn't meaning to lay blame at the church. Like, this is a good reason to blame your church and leave the pastor. What I'm saying is, if you're identifying this as reality, and the reality might be, to your point, I can't manage this well, and I got to choose.
Right.
Do I go all in on the church and let my family burn to the ground, or do I let somebody else shepherd this flock and I take care of my family? That's a legitimate thing. If you're self-aware enough to realize you can't handle it all, then yeah, I would agree.
Right.
Through prayer and leading from God, again, which he hasn't mentioned or talked about.
But anyway, so he goes on to say, I'm jumping ahead by one line in this case. Being a pastor is like being a parent. You can imagine what it's like. By the way, that's not entirely true, but I hear what he's saying. He says, you can imagine what it's like to have a child, but until you're in the role, you can't fully appreciate what it's like to shoulder the responsibility of caring for a life 24/7. Same is true for being a pastor. As a pastor, you're there for all the peaks and the valleys. You're there to celebrate the weddings and the births. You're also there for the sicknesses, the tragedies, the deaths. I don't think anyone becomes a pastor not knowing this is what you're signing up for. However, the reality of what this does to you mentally and emotionally is taxing over the long haul. I have thoughts on this, but I don't want to make this about me. What do you guys say to that?
I want to get to the next paragraph because I think
My concern here is, first of all, making that connection to parenting. Boy, that's an ill-founded and really ill-thought-out analogy to make, because he's right. You don't know how demanding being a parent is going to be until you're a parent. But you can't leave being a parent.
Right.
The analogy falls down almost immediately.
Yeah. Right. It's not something you get to choose to depart from when it doesn't work out for you.
Yeah. So, all right. So Daniel wants to get into this next segment. Okay. Says, for most of my tenure at First Pres, name of his church, we had around 1,000 members. Of those, about 50% attended on a regular basis. I really got to know about 300 people beyond name recognition. There's a problem right there, by the way.
He only knows
a third of his congregation.
Right, and that's because his congregation is too big. And what we're going to see as we go further in the article is he doesn't have a support structure. In a church that size, if indeed you can even have a church that size, which we've talked on this program about before, but if you're going to do it, you need a number of people in leadership staff that are actively discipling and knowing all these people, all these members of the congregation. You can't personally visit and talk to every one of those, even 300 people, in a week's time.
Maybe like Moses, a leader of 50s, break them up in 50s, have
10,
leaders.
Yeah. 10s, 50s, 100s, so on, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so size does matter. In this case, size works to your disadvantage.
The wisdom of Jethro.
And there are ways to do it, but you have to have a multiplicity of elders on staff to help manage this. Right?
Which is one of the things that's surprising, because he's talking about a Presbyterian church, and normally those are fairly well organized from a leadership perspective. Whether we agree with the specific church on the doctrines and things, and this sounds like it's one of the more liberal Presbyterian churches.
Yeah, it's PCUSA,
but they have a presbytery, right? It's in the name. So there's supposed to be a plurality of elders and accountability structure, and what he's describing doesn't seem to have any of that.
But he talks about the 300 people he kind of knows beyond name recognition. He says, what this means is that I know these, basically these 300 people. I know their stories, their history, intimate details of their lives. Sometimes this happened because there was a crisis. Sometimes I learned these things while performing the functions in their lives, like funerals, weddings, baptisms. Irrespective of how I learned their story, I carry that history wherever I go. Whenever I see them, I know that I know intimate details, or they know that I know intimate details about their lives, details that they rarely share with others. Since I see these people most every week, that personal information is always at the top of my mind. Over time, the accumulation of all that knowledge starts to weigh you down. Your mind is a repository for all sorts of secrets, and if you're human, you feel sympathy and empathy for their suffering. Like almost every facet of being a pastor, this is a double-edged sword. It's a privilege to be given a window into these very private aspects of their lives, but a responsibility that comes with that privilege can sometimes be overwhelming. To be honest, this is the one part of the entire thing he had to say. I think he's right. Mm-hmm. If you haven't been a pastor, I think the only thing that would be a corollary to this is if you are a counselor, right?
Yeah.
People are coming to you, sharing the challenges, these deep, dark, scary, embarrassing challenges in their life. Nobody in the world knows. Sometimes their spouse doesn't know, at least not at first. Right? And it's there are things you know, and I can speak to this. It's on your mind, like, all the freaking time. It's all the time on your mind. You're trying to think about how can you help them, and you're praying for them either aloud or in your spirit.
And you go see the person, and you look at them, and you know that they know that you know what's going on.
And I don't mean it, and I don't ever feel embarrassed about that. And I think he almost feels like there's a sense of embarrassment. Maybe they feel embarrassed, the people. I never feel a sense of embarrassment. I hope that they don't feel embarrassed because they shared it with me. If they were that embarrassed, they wouldn't share it. But it's heavy on your heart. And it's there. It's always there. And everybody's got challenges. And some of the people that are coming to you for pastoral counseling, they really have challenges. And you're rooting for them. And you're trying everything you can to help them. And they can't get out of their own way sometimes. And so that part really resonated. That is one of the big, big challenges of being a pastor. You guys have that experience?
I agree. He's got a point. Yeah, but everything so far I've said is he is quitting a job, not a calling. Okay, this is a tech job or a bricklaying job that he's just tired of because too much on his body and his mind, and he can't take it anymore. He's not in a pastoral position to care for the sheep. He doesn't seem like he has a heart for that, and it doesn't seem like that is what God's placed on his heart. He's there purely to make a paycheck for his family.
Yeah, and for other reasons that aren't pastoral, which we're going to get to as we read on. And this is, again, good riddance. We don't need men like this in pastoral roles. He doesn't have a heart for it. Doesn't have a calling, apparently, on his life for it. And, yeah, so my point in saying I get it. I get where he's coming from. But the next thing to say is, okay, but so what? That's what pastors do. And if you can't do that, you don't want to do that, you probably should have never been a pastor. I don't know how he survived his 10 years as a pastor. Mm-hmm. I don't know how he did it.
Right.
All right, I dominated that one. I'm going to be less verbose on this next one. Next section. Another aspect of being a pastor is that you don't have just one boss. As a pastor, yes, you do. But anyway. As a pastor, you're ultimately responsible. Ultimately, he used that word, by the way. I didn't insert that. You're ultimately responsible to a board of or governing body that oversees your ministry.
No, you're ultimately responsible to Christ.
However, in practice, your boss is every person who walks through the door.
That's wrong.
Oh my gosh. When everyone likes what you're doing, it may not feel that way, but the moment a group of people becomes discontent with your messages or decisions, then you feel the weight of their leverage over your life. In this way, the pastorate is similar to politics. There's some truth to that. I've been the target of mudslinging. Some members have taken steps to create a movement to have me removed from my post. At first, it was an underground movement to convince the governing board of the church that a majority of the parishioners were discontent with my leadership. When that effort was unsuccessful, they went public, sending out an email to the entire congregation to build momentum to have me forcibly removed. I'm going to pause there. So the last part of what he said, some of that resonates as true, but boy, the opening part of that section I just read, holy cow, he couldn't be more wrong. Anyway, you guys.
Again, I don't think he still think he hasn't mentioned the word God yet.
No.
I don't know that he's saved. It doesn't seem like it.
And literally, that's the main thing. Start with God. But so many times.
You're misunderstanding Daniel, because he's not ultimately responsible to God.
Ultimately responsible to the presbytery.
And to the governing board, and to every person who walks through the door.
So what he's trying to say is you can't please everybody.
And that's true.
If you have a large congregation, whatever you say, somebody's going to be annoyed, either because you called them out on something that was legitimately sinful in their life, and they know it, and they're embarrassed by it, or because you're wrong in some other way and they're upset with you, or just because different people have different personalities and they don't get along. So there's always going to be that.
His security does not seem to be in his relationship with God, right? And his desire to obey and honor God.
What is the proper response when you have this kind of campaign in the church to get you removed? Or to get you to change something? There's one of two things could be true. Either you are preaching the gospel and it's so strong that the devil's trying to tear you down in any way he can. And in that case, blessed are you because you're persecuted for the kingdom of God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So you should be glad and happy when that happens. Or you really are preaching heresy and should be called out, in which case that's the job of the congregation, is to create a grassroots movement to say, hey, go to the elders. This guy's not teaching us from the Bible. We need to get this changed. That is exactly the responsibility of the church. So, I get the, based on what some things he's saying here, I get the impression that they didn't go about it the right way, even if that's what they were trying to do. But still, you should expect this type of thing.
And I do want to take a moment here. We're picking on this pastor and pastors like him because, again, it's a case study. He's representative of a disease right now that's, it's very contagious and it's spreading like crazy. That's why we have the problems we have in the world today, have you noticed? But I want to take a second here and turn the gun around. Congregation, listener, if you're not a pastor but you're part of a church, you need to hear this. The politics inside the church has got to stop. And if you're participating in that, if you're one of the wolves who's trying to tear down your pastor, particularly if he's if he's not faithful, you go about it in biblical, God-ordained ways of dealing with it. You don't go about it the way it's being described here. But if your pastor is taking friendly fire from you, it needs to stop. You can work through the channels if he needs to be removed. He's preaching heresy or his leadership is completely obtuse and he needs to be held to account. I'm not saying the pastors are above being held to account, but there's a way to do it, and politicking isn't the way to do it. And so if that's what you're doing, if you fancy yourself some sort of church boss working behind the scenes to gather a storm of people who want to come together and ambush the pastor, you are in gross, heinous kind of sin. And if you got to repent now, even if your pastor's not doing a good job, that doesn't give you an excuse to not be a good Christian. And there's too much of this. There are churches in this town I'm familiar with. I've pastored one of them, but there are others I haven't pastored. I'm not making this personal right now. They have a reputation. They can't keep their pastors. It's like a rotisserie league. It's like every couple of years, they almost had a church split. They had to fire the pastor. Wow, hopefully they figured it out. A couple of years later, almost had a church split. They fired the pastor. Or sometimes they had a church split and half the congregation went with the pastor and they hired a new pastor. That has got to stop. Hear me, please. For your own salvation, stop, because you've got to repent. You are in sin if that's you. And it's a real, real problem in the church. It doesn't get talked about very much because pastors want to come across as whining crybabies and talk about it. And if once they get fired and if they bring it up, it's like, sour grapes. It's a reality and it has got to stop. So anyway, enough sermonizing at you, unless you guys want to sermonize.
No.
All right, the next section here talks about unrealistic expectations. He starts off with some complaints about the degree requirements and the low pay and the student debt that they have to carry and all that sort of stuff. And then he transitions to say this. There are...
Which, by the way, all that should not be required to become a pastor.
I agree.
In fact, in many of these things are actually, in my opinion, detriments on your resume if you've gone to seminary. Yeah. One of the
and you mentioned that before, and I mentioned, I think it was last week's show, I hear you, or maybe it was earlier this show, I agree with your heart on that sort of thing, but if if understood and used properly, seminaries can be a blessing to the church because they help to...
Could have been in the past. I think most seminaries are no longer...
But if you go there to learn how to read and understand Greek and Hebrew and how to properly exegete a passage...
I agree.
Some of those kinds of things can be helpful, but so many of the seminaries are so far gone now.
What I'm saying, I agree with that concept. I'm saying I don't believe there's more than maybe... a handful in the country, the seminaries that actually still exist, that even teach that.
And what should happen is it should be happening in the church. The problem is most pastors aren't equipped to teach men how to, self-included, by the way. I know just enough Greek and Hebrew to muddle by. I used to know it way better when I was in seminary. I knew it well enough to pass the test and get a good grade and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, it gets rusty if you're not in it all the time, and when you're exegeting the New Testament, you're not exegeting the Old Testament, so you're not practicing your Hebrew. And if you're in a sermon series on the Hebrew text, you're not using your Greek, and you go 3, 6 months or 9 months or whatever, and you're not in the languages, it starts to get rusty really fast. So I can muddle through, and I'm very dependent on the tools. But at least I have that. But I'm not in a position to, if somebody said, hey, pastor, can you teach me Greek? Yeah, you better go to seminary for that because I'm not going to be able to help you, you know. So it has a role. I don't want to gang up on the seminaries too much, but I hear what you're saying. I don't know if I'm going to have time I'll read as much as I can and we'll see how this goes. There are 7 areas where a pastor is expected to be proficient. First and foremost, you're expected to be a professional speaker. Makes sense. Personally, I love this part of the job, but many of the people I went to seminary with struggled with public speaking. If you fall into this category, immediately you have a problem since what most people see is your public speaking on Sunday. Second required skill is that you're like a CEO of a company, anticipating not only what the current people of your church want, but also how to bring new people through the door.
Wrong.
You have to grow the business.
And
under the conditions we're in now, that's super difficult because the culture is such that people don't really want to go to church anymore. You also have to be a professional.
I had to stop you there. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, we haven't paused there.
There's a verse in the New Testament where Paul's talking on some kind of unrelated topic. I think he's talking about speaking orderly in the church and not talking over each other. And he makes it a side comment. It's like, so that if an unbeliever happens to walk in the door, he's not confused or he doesn't have a bad opinion of Christians. Like, if an unbeliever walks in the door, like, it's a rare thing. It's not a normal – it's not what you're expecting. This culture of, oh, just come to church and we'll teach you there. No. Get saved, then we disciple you, then you come into the church. Alongside with that, it's not come to the church, listen for several months, a year or two, maybe someday you'll decide you want to be saved. No, you know, we're not marketers. The church is not a marketing organization bringing people in to the Sunday morning service. You may be going and providing outreach and ministry and preaching in the streets and get people saved. And once you're saved, yes, come to church. Get discipled.
Yeah, it's a real problem. You have too many churches that run like businesses, and you have too many businesses that fancy themselves ministries or whatever, and they try to run their businesses like churches. Like, you know, churches need to be run like churches. Businesses should be run like businesses. You know, you try to blend those two, and you get into all sorts of problems. And actually, we did a show on that years ago. Maybe someday we'll bring that issue up again. The one thing I want to say is you have to be apt to teach and to be a pastor, and that means you should be able to communicate. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't mean you have to be the most polished public speaker at all, but you should be able to stand up and proclaim the gospel and exhort people unto obedience and those sorts of things. And so public speaking might not be the best way to think about how to describe that, but that seems like something that should be kind of expected from a pastor.
That first point was reasonable, yeah. I just don't like him saying he has to be the CEO of a company to grow the organization.
Even in a house church, you can't be a wilting flower. You got 20 people in your house, and you're like, oh, bashful. Ooh, there's 20 people. It's like that's 40 eyeballs on me. I'm not comfortable talking. You got to be able to do that. Bare minimum, you got to be able to do that. So anyway.
Right.
So we've got about half of his list or whatever of things that are expected for pastors to be able to do. We'll get to the rest of that list next week and finish out his article. We're about halfway through, at least halfway through the part that I wanted us to pay attention to. So I think we're making good time as far as getting this done in 2 episodes.
Yep.
So that will be our goal. Again, we're talking about, what is this thing called? Departing, why I left the church. And one of the things I'm hoping we'll see, that we're talking about a pastor specifically, but the kinds of things he's talking about more broadly could apply to just a Christian in general. What I think is going on here is that this quote-unquote pastor has deconstructed his faith. I agree with Imran. I don't think he's a believer. And he has deconstructed his faith, and he's walking away from the church. I think that's kind of what's going on, and so...
No, he's not walking away from the church. He's walking away from a job. He was never part of the church.
Well, okay, yeah. Fair enough. He's going to go get a different paycheck. All right, so.
Somebody let us pay back his student loans, apparently.
Yeah, so Imran threw down the gauntlet on that one. I stand corrected. Imran Razvi, you can find him online at conqueredbylove.org. You can find Daniel Razvi there as well. They've got a church in the Thurmond area. David Forsey is a pastor of a house church that each week meets in kind of a different location, so you kind of got to go hunting and pecking to find him. But the easiest way to connect with him is just reach out to me. Go to householdoffaithinchrist.com. All my contact information is there. And say, hey, I'm trying to get in touch with David, and I'll be glad to just set that up for you. And, of course, if you want to get in touch with me, you can also go to householdoffaithinchrist.com. If it's hate mail related, though, I'm not interested in it. Actually, those are sometimes the best ones. So send all the hate mail you want. We'll be back next week with the Faith Debate. Oh, I guess I should plug the radio station. WFMD.com is their website. Till next week, 167 and a half hours from now, God bless.